Good morning, everyone. 8:06 on your Wednesday morning. It's September 22nd. I'm Sean Higgins at the KPCW studios in Park City, sitting in for Leslie Thatcher this morning. Well, it's a little bit warmer than we saw yesterday. Going to be another gorgeous day in the Wasatch. Back with all of that information and more. On the line with me now is ABC4 meteorologist Thomas Gaboy. Good morning, Thomas.
Good morning and happy Wednesday. We're halfway to the weekend, and like you mentioned, this morning we're starting off just a little bit warmer, and you would normally kind of associate that being opposite because today is going to be the first day of fall. The autumnal equinox will be happening at 1:20 this afternoon. That's when the sun's rays are directly on the equator, so we're transitioning into the fall season. But all that really means for us is that our days are going to be getting shorter and shorter, and the nights will be getting longer and longer. But this morning it's still a little bit on the chilly side along the Wasatch. Back in Park City, sitting at 39 degrees right now. In Alta, yesterday we were talking at this time temperatures being in the 20s, now sitting at 36, and in Heber it's 32. So there are still some cold spots out there at the freezing mark. But by this afternoon, that chill is going to be gone. So over the last couple of days, we've seen our temperatures go from daytime highs in the 50s to the 60s yesterday, and we're likely going to see daytime highs today in the lower 70s. But with a lot of sunshine out there, it is going to be a beautiful day. It's a perfect day to spend some time outside, and you'll also have a light southerly breeze anywhere from 5 to 10 miles per hour. As we go into tonight, with a continued westerly flow in the higher levels of the atmosphere, that's going to start to bring in a little bit more smoke. So after a nice reprieve in the smoke, you're probably going to start noticing it by this evening into tomorrow as our skies become a little bit more hazy, leading to moderate air quality. But for tonight, an overnight low in the upper 40s in Park City, so about 5 to 10 degrees warmer than what we're finding this morning. And with the system moving in tomorrow, we're probably going to find a little bit more cloud coverage, but the system moving in looks like it's going to be predominantly dry. I wouldn't be completely surprised if you get up to about 8,000-9,000 feet that you see a light sprinkle or two, but there's really just not a lot of moisture that this system's going to have to work with. So a little extra cloud coverage, and this should help keep our temperatures really consistent heading into the upcoming weekend, with a daytime high tomorrow 71 degrees with patchy smoke, and we'll see overnight low Thursday night into Friday morning at 45. On Friday, a northerly flow takes over. This should help out with the smoke a little bit. The daytime high going to continue to be in the lower 70s, but with high pressure kind of controlling our weather heading into this upcoming weekend, those daytime highs will favor more so the middle 70s for your Saturday and Sunday with mostly sunny skies. So this weekend looks to be a great weekend if you want to spend some time outside. Overnight lows will continue to hold steady in the middle to upper 40s. Then as we go into the early stage of next week, we're kind of seeing a little bit of a split in the models, where Monday looks like it's going to be sunny with a high of 75 degrees with an overnight low Monday night into Tuesday morning at 49. But some models are trending a little bit wetter for Tuesday, where we could see a slight chance of showers, but it's not a guarantee at this point. So we'll be watching for the early stages of next week. Can't rule out the chance of rain, but also don't be surprised if it's going to be staying on the dry side. But temperatures for daytime highs look like they're going to continue to be in the lower 70s through at least next Tuesday.
Sounds wonderful, Thomas. Thank you so much, as always, and we'll talk to you tomorrow.
Sounds good. Have a good one.
All right, you too. Well, a Wasatch County Service organization made up of community volunteers is looking for support as it helps residents. KPCW's Ben Lassiter has more on what's happening with the Wasatch County Community Foundation.
The majority of the organization's funding comes from donations. During the remainder of this year, the foundation's looking to form a group of 100 sustaining donors. Chair of the foundation board, Tom Fowler, hopes these can come from outside Wasatch County as well as within.
Our efforts are truly for the families and individuals in Wasatch County. That's who we are. But I would like to say a lot of these individuals, a lot of these family members living in Wasatch County are working in Park City. So I would ask the businesses, I would ask the individuals in Summit and Park City to help us help them if they can.
The Wasatch Community Foundation formed in 2000 to centralize many independent service efforts going on locally then. Now, with a team of over 50 volunteers, it's the largest nonprofit in the county. Fowler says the foundation works to assess community needs and maximize resources.
First of all, our mission is really to help advance the well-being of Wasatch County residents by uniting community resources and programs. And how do we do that? We do that through our structure. We call them areas of focus, and those areas include health, education, recreation, arts, and human services.
For example, with the economic challenges the COVID-19 pandemic has brought on, the foundation has been focusing on human services. Fowler said it paid over $300,000 of residents' bills in the past year. Some primary partners for that fundraising effort were the Christian Church of Park City, St. Mary's Church, and St. Lawrence Church in Heber City. Another primary focus is in the health pillar. The annual Children's Health Clinic offers free wellness exams and vaccinations to children who don't have insurance. The most recent clinic took place in early August, right before school started. Coming up in a couple months is the annual Community Thanksgiving Dinner. It's a free meal for up to 500 with music and festivities. Some recurring initiatives benefit school supply drives, food pantries, and recreation and arts facilities. Board member Jerry Pitts, who oversees fundraising, says donors have control over their gifts. One primary reason for that is the option to contribute to specific events or pillars within the foundation. Team members are volunteers and administration fees are minimal, so about 99% of donations go toward helping county residents and projects. To visit the Wasatch Community Foundation website, go to ourwcf.org. That's ourwcf.org. Ben Lassiter, KPCW News.
Well, the heads of the Park City Education Association met with district administration on Monday to explore options to cover the costs of teachers using time off when quarantining for COVID-19 illness or exposure. Carolyn Murray has this.
Mary Morgan is co-president of the Park City Education Association, Park City's biggest teachers union. KPCW reported last week that three of the four Wasatch-backed school districts are requiring district employees to use personal time off when they quarantine due to COVID. Morgan said the meeting with Superintendent Jill Gilday and Human Resources Director Shad Sorensen was very productive. The Education Association is hopeful they will come to a resolution soon on funding sick days due to quarantine.
There are a few options for federal grants that we are working on together so that teachers aren't having to take their own time off due to COVID absences. We are also looking at other school districts that are funding COVID leave for teachers and how those are funded. We do feel that there are some really positive options and that we are really hoping that some of those will become viable possibilities for funding COVID leave in in the foreseeable future. In addition, we want to say that we are definitely grateful to district admin, Dr. Gilday, Dr. Sorensen, for working together with us to come up with some real solutions for teachers.
Morgan said the school district is considering a nearly $70,000 grant, which she believes would go a long way to help cover absences caused by COVID-related quarantine.
There was one grant, I believe, that was around $69,000, which would be a really good chunk of change to be able to use for that funding. But as far as a set amount, we haven't really discussed a set amount.
North Summit School District does not require staff to use PTO or personal time off when quarantining. Superintendent Jerry Holmes said his district hoped to be back on its regular sick leave contract this year, but saw COVID was still an issue, so they decided to shift money to include more substitute funding.
Obviously, when you do that, you cut somewhere else, but we just felt like in order to honor what we're trying to do, and that is stay home when we're sick, that we didn't want to punish teachers, especially if they are having to quarantine for the 10 to 14 days, that would wipe out their sick leave for the year. And it was just a matter of shifts that we made to try to send a message not only to our teachers but to parents and students that's one of our biggest weapons in this is to stay home when we're sick.
Morgan said a few grants need to be submitted quickly, and the district is hoping to have identified funding sources in the next few weeks. Carolyn Murray, KPCW News.
Well, the Park City School District held a school board meeting last night to discuss the upcoming general obligation bond and a number of other things. Joining me right now in the studio to discuss that and everything else covered last night is Park City School District Business Administrator Todd Hauber. Todd, good morning.
Good morning.
And joining us on the line is Board Member Andrew Kaplan. Andrew, good morning. Thank you for joining us.
Good morning.
So we heard a lot about the public hearing on the general obligation bond, and Todd, this is not to exceed just under $80 million, is that number correct?
Correct, $79.2 million is the maximum.
Mm-hmm. And there was a public hearing last night to take comment on the proposed school bond initiative, but we didn't hear much from the public. Andrew, do you think that bodes well for a successful school bond approval?
It's a good question. I think that this master planning process, which of course includes the school bond as well as some alternative financing sources, has been a lengthy process that's involved the public all along the way. So I think this time around it's a little bit different in that most of the folks who follow education in town and, you know, have interest in the bond have been participating in this process for the past 3 years. And, you know, it's a good opportunity to reiterate that the building projects that are being considered here are coming from the public. They're coming from our focus groups and literally thousands of hours of input from, you know, teachers, students, parents, community members, and the facilities reflect the community's interest. So I'm not terribly surprised that, you know, there hasn't been a ton of input recently. We've been doing our best to communicate what these facilities are going to look like, what the costs are, how we're paying for them for several years now. And so, you know, we're hopeful that the community continues to support our efforts and we continue to move forward this fall.
And Todd, you explained that legally last night, the declaration of support of the school bond initiative was the last time the board could publicly state their support or opposition to it. You also mentioned there's a lot of detail on the school district website. Can you remind us where people can find these details and the arguments for and against this bond?
Yes. So if you go to the pcschools.us website, you'll see they're right on the homepage. Right below the banner is a link straight to the Future of Learning, which has all of the information with regards to where the district's been in the past. It has the proposition language explicitly there, so you can see what you'll be looking at when your ballot comes to you in the mail. And so there's just multiple links. There's an FAQ on there. There's voter information. There's project information. So it's all right there. We tried to make it really simple to find right on that main page.
And is this all part of the legal requirement that states both for and against have to be published?
Correct. Yeah, that's legal. And this time around, there weren't any arguments submitted against the bond proposition. So we're hopeful that's a message as well.
Mm-hmm. So let's talk a little bit about master planning. The board voted unanimously to ratify the MHTN Architects contract and the Hughes BCBO contract for the expansion of all four of the elementary schools. How far along on the process are we on expanding those elementary schools?
So we're right at the threshold of that right now in awarding that contract. So I put those notices out last night to the firms. We'll be meeting with them either the end of this week or the start of next week to open up contract negotiations. And the first step is the pre-design work. So we'll have our stakeholder meetings and things of that nature to make sure that the projects are still filled out the way they were envisioned.
And MHTN Architects also gave an overview to the board. Their representative, Scott Lader, showed you what the implementation plan is for beginning to phase the high school expansions. So they've started phasing those already?
So in the design work, we're phasing. So we're trying to figure out how to have the least amount of impact on the students, have the least amount of classrooms not available for instruction. So the phasing that we're looking at there is on that west side of the high school, the north part of the designs would go in first, and then that would leave room on the south side to keep classes going and students have a place to be. And then we'd go into the south side. So it really is a two-phase on that west side of the high school. And that's what we were looking at.
And I understand this project is targeted to run about $50 million, is that correct?
Yeah, about $54 million total cost, yeah.
And how is this moving ahead when the GO bond has not yet been approved by the voters? Is there a surplus of funds, something like that?
Yeah, so what we have in place right now with Hogan and MHTN is a limited scope contract, which is basically this pre-design work. Knowing that we want to have all of these projects done by the third quarter of 2024, we have to start the design work now in order to meet that deadline. And so we just have a limited scope. There's limited exposure to expense till we get to the bond, and then we'll see what the outcome of the bond presents to us.
And there was also a brief update on the Eckerhill Middle School expansion. Will that, I believe it's about a $30 million project, also proceed if there's no bond approval?
So we'll begin with the pre-design work as well on that. That project in particular is designed to be financed through an alternative financing structure. So it doesn't have the same constraints in place, but we'll keep the two projects moving in parallel with each other.
Mm-hmm. And there's the various elementary school expansions on that same kind of program as well?
Correct, yeah. So you have two that we're proposing be funded through the GO bond, and then we have two that will be be through the alternate financing.
Mm-hmm. And will all of these be done simultaneously? Is this going to be phased? What timeline on this portion of the master plan?
Yeah, so that great question. So the high school's already in the pre-design phase right now with the award of the Ecker last night. We will get into that pre-phase. And then we will also do the same thing with the elementaries, but their actual construction dates will be staggered. So the high school will start first, Ecker shortly thereafter. And then the proposal from Hughes and VCBO is that we would take on two of the elementaries together, and then the final two all being completed in that 2024 timeframe.
Mm-hmm. I want to touch briefly on the quarantine policy. We just heard that report from Carolyn Murray. Like several other school districts in the Wasatch Pack, Park City School District does follow Utah Department of Health guidelines, which is the answer that is given about why quarantine isn't covered separately for staff. Andrew, do these guidelines say education staff should not have access to more than the contracted personal time off, even if it is COVID-related?
I'm not familiar with the exact details of the guidelines from the federal government. Yeah, that'd be a question for Dr. Sorensen. But, you know, as was stated, we have a really good relationship with PCEA. You know, from the board's perspective, we have, you know, continuously prioritized all matters with regards to compensation for our educators, and that, you know, that remains. And, you know, we're working with the PCEA to figure out solutions, which include, you know, getting federal grants, which is what we did last year as well. And look, this isn't a Park City problem. This is a nationwide problem. And, you know, it's another example of, you know, the country just trying to find its way with regards to COVID and how that works with education. And I'm pretty confident that Dr. Sorensen and Dr. Gilday will be able to work with PCEA and come to an amicable resolution for both sides. But yeah, I mean, we have it's a good dialogue that we're having, and they've always been good partners, and we all want to make sure that we can do what we can within you know, federal guidelines and within labor laws and all of that. So, you know, watch this space, but I'm confident we'll get that fixed.
Mm-hmm. And the Utah Department of Health, recently reported student cases they believe are underreported because of people without symptoms just simply not wanting to quarantine. We see the statewide numbers and obviously single-digit numbers in the schools in Park City. Andrew, do you believe there is any credence to those reports circulating about the numbers not being correct?
Well, I think it's tough to say, right? If you're saying that the issue is that people are asymptomatic, well, I'm not sure how you would address that other than, you know, testing students every day, which isn't practical from a implementation or a cost perspective. You know, I think we have, we're very fortunate that we have a very highly vaccinated community. I think we have parents and community members who are very diligent about COVID mitigation and mitigation strategies. We have an administration that has done an excellent job in terms of multi-layered mitigation, from air circulation to, you know, other hygiene preventative measures. And look, you know, we as a district, we're taking it very seriously. But again, I don't think there's anyone who's trying to beat the system. I think there's everyone's doing the best they can and reporting what they can. And, you know, I think kids are staying home when they have the sniffles, whereas otherwise they wouldn't in previous years. And so everyone's doing as best as they can. And, you know, and so far, the mitigation measures as well as parental involvement and diligence have worked, and our case counts are low. And, you know, the community continues to do well through the pandemic. So, you know, I choose to focus on the positives and the good work that the administration and our parents have done, and the good work that our kids are doing in school, you know, to, you know, follow guidelines and follow rules.
And is there concern that teachers who have been exposed but aren't ill will still come to school because of some of these time off issues?
I don't believe so. I mean, I think everyone's aware of individual responsibility, you know, and that goes for, as I just mentioned, parents, students, teachers. I think we've been in this for almost 2 years now, and I think we've all accepted personal responsibility. And I don't believe that any of our educators would ever go to work knowingly sick. We don't have any examples of that. And likewise, I don't think parents are sending students to school that are knowingly sick. But part of our reality is that, you know, there are asymptomatic cases, and that's not a school issue. That's an issue that exists in our society, right? You know, you have 60,000 people every weekend down at the U at the football games. You have 100,000 people in every NFL stadium across the country. Some of those people are going to be asymptomatic, and you know, that's the new normal for our country and our state. And I think people are going to continue to live their lives and do so in a responsible way. And you know, the schools are no different. So I don't believe anyone is intentionally circumventing rules or putting others at risk. I choose to believe that we live in a good community with caring individuals, and everyone's responsible for themselves. And you know, and that's held true for the last year and a half in school. We've had low numbers, we've had very low community spread, and I think that's reflective of the job that the community has done.
And before we run out of time, I do want to touch on a brief update Mike Tanner gave. You mentioned some hiring challenges. Is the school, I'm not sure which one of you is actually better equipped to answer this question, what kind of hiring issues are being seen at the school district?
So a couple of areas. One is we have the same challenge that the nation is having with recruiting bus drivers. So anyone with a CDL license out there, if you hear me talking, please give us a call. We'd really like to get you into a bus. But that's probably one of our major areas, is making sure that we have transportation going. In our food services area, having those kitchen workers there helping and making sure food, all the meals are at no cost to the students. So that obviously ticked up demand, and so we need more hands on deck. And so we, in those areas, and then always substitute teachers when people do call out because they're being responsible, because they're ill, we need that substitute force in place, and it's just not as deep as it used to be. So really in need of substitute teachers as well.
And with many companies recently announcing their plans to pay $15 an hour, some even more, can the school district keep pace with that minimum hourly rate?
No, that's a challenge. Yeah. So fortunately, I don't know that the board foresaw COVID, but when we put the 4-year contract in place for all the employee groups, there are salary increases taking place annually, and large ones, you know, 4% to 5%. So hopefully that keeps us in pace. And then even this last budget cycle, the board allocated additional dollars to address specific employee groups that we saw shortages, and we knew that salary was going to be the solution.
Todd, one last question before we go. If the $79 million bond does not pass, what happens next?
You know, I hope we don't get there, honestly. It's we've worked with the community so closely. All the projects, I think, are without question at this time, that the needs are there and understood, and that these are the right solutions to be putting in place. And so on a project basis, we really need to see that the students are well taken care of. And so really, the best I can say is please go out and vote. Vote whatever way you need to. But we, you know, get out and let us know what you're thinking.
Well, thank you for that. Well, that's Park City School District Business Administrator Todd Hauber and Board Member Andrew Kaplan. Todd and Andrew, thank you both so much for your time.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Well, it's been a busy week for the people over at the Marsec Building in Park City. There was a city council retreat yesterday, Planning Commission tonight, and City Council on Thursday. Joining me now in the studio with a recap of yesterday and a preview of what is to come, Park City Manager Matt Dias. Matt, good morning. Thanks for joining us.
Good morning, Sean. Thanks for having me.
So it looks like you guys had a pretty packed day yesterday with the council retreat. A lot on the agenda and a lot of ground covered. Was this kind of a continuation of what happened in May with the two-day retreat, or was this something different?
I mean, it's a little bit different, but each year, twice a year, our council has every year they have a retreat, and then about 6 months into the year they have a semi-annual retreat where you can take a step back, take stock of the progress that's made, and determine how things are working, how things are going with the city. And this year's was a little bit different. We actually had our semi-annual retreat outside, so I didn't sleep well the night before. I was worried it was going to be so cold and it was going to be uncomfortable for the public and some of our
elected officials. It was pretty chilly yesterday.
But fortunately, it worked out. We had very favorable weather. We had actually a fairly strong attendance from members of the public comparatively to what we normally have. And this year was a little bit different in that we had the elected officials take a leadership role on our Vision 2020 pillars. And so we created task forces under each pillar that are led by the council members. And they got to report in to their own council members and the public. And it was kind of an 8 or 9 hour session. We did spend some time at the Public Works Yard with many of our frontline workers, and we had a great day.
Mm-hmm. So obviously you mentioned the strategic pillars: authentic local culture, social equity and affordability, transportation innovation, environmental leadership were all covered. Also housing task force. What were some of the highlights of yesterday?
Yeah, I think that you covered that pretty well in terms of transportation, authentic local culture, equity, diversity, inclusion, housing, and environment. And I would say that the conclusion was there are no major pivots, that we're on the right path, we're on the right track, but there are some opportunities in our policies, our programs, and initiatives. So we reported in on the Transit to Trails program, which was a recent accomplishment, temporary activation of the area in Bonanza Park known as the Arts and Culture District. The transportation group was able to report in on the long-range transportation plan that we're nearing completion, the walkability plan that's underway. The housing department was reporting in on the public-private partnership that we're contemplating for the Homestake lot to develop more affordable and community housing. The work we're doing out on Clark Ranch to potentially do some housing out there near the Park City Heights neighborhood. And then a host of equity, diversity, and inclusion updates. The LGBTIAQ task force that's underway. We have all sorts of things that council is debating and talking about, poking and prodding. I think the biggest takeaway was no major pivots at this point.
Mm-hmm. And I want to touch something on the housing task force. Obviously, people are hypersensitive to things getting built these days. I know there was some chatter on social media yesterday. People saw a number for the PEG development about the housing there. Some people thought that was kind of a foregone conclusion that it would get built. Was that just added as a potential add to the housing number, or was that something else?
Perhaps I was like you. I think when that was put up, I received some messages on my phone as well. I think that chart was categorizing existing obligations from developers, potential future obligations from developers, and then city-constructed affordable or community housing. And so any notion for a project that was in the development process or was being contemplated was highlighted in yellow, was in a separate section, and so was delineated as such. But the point of it all was to be able to take a step back and contemplate what things might look like towards our affordable housing community goals if these projects do move along. And again, I think that chart had sort of three categories: the work that we've done to date, the work that is currently approved or in the pipeline, and things that may come down the line.
Mm-hmm. So no fire alarms just yet from you guys.
No, I think we understand the community's sensitivity, but it was clearly delineated that that wasn't a foregone conclusion or anything like that. But we've got to talk about it, that if that development or Deer Valley or another significant development in our community were to move forward, there are affordable and community housing components of that. That's something that we're going to want to know, forecast, look at in the future, and account for in our planning.
Mm-hmm. So let's move on to Thursday's meeting. Quite a dense work session. Usually it's been one topic in these work sessions over the past few months. I see three: Future of Empire Creek, drought conservation, and then a Parley's Canyon fire incident. Empire Creek, what's the situation over there?
Oh, gosh. So, you know, this goes back even before my time with the city, but back in around 2012, 13, 14, the city went through what's called a stipulated compliance order with the Utah Department of Environmental Quality. So that's a really wonky way of saying that, you know, we were regulated by the EPA and the environmental agency within Utah with regard to the water coming out of the Judge Tunnel. So to orient the community, this is the area sort of above Daly Canyon, or way up the way the crow flies above Main Street. And there is a mine tunnel up there that was obviously punctured a long time ago when it was dug. And the result was a lot of water comes out of that. And for I guess, decades, our community actually used to drink the water directly out of that mine source. Well, now we are obligated to treat that water. And so we have created a pipeline back in 2015 to pipeline that water to the new treatment plant that we're making along the Gulf Course. And so that creek was a seasonal creek for as long as anyone can remember, and the existing plan is that it would revert back to a seasonal creek. Now, that being said, I understand there's an emotional argument where everyone loves water in their backyard. Everyone wants a babbling brook, but you know, the previous plans were to comply with the state and federal regulations, and you know, we're not asking for a council decision this evening. We understand this is an emotional issue, people seeing you know, what was once a year-round creek revert back to a seasonal creek. So we're just asking council, what type of scoping do they want on any public engagement or public outreach and public information process?
Mm-hmm. And speaking of water, drought and water conservation update there. Obviously, a lot has been reported on the historic drought happening in Utah right now. Are you expecting anything too much different than the last time we heard from the water division on this? Or
yes, no? Actually, you know, the city council and mayor have challenged us, and this aligns with our environmental pillar, to be far more aggressive when it comes to water conservation and drought resistant measures in our community. So there's sort of three components to this, to simplify things, but we will be having a conversation about rate adjustments. We will be having conversations about our zoning, about our landscaping codes that we were require for new development, commercial development, and a bunch of zero-scape initiatives for existing development so we can participate in some of the cash for grass programs that we've heard about elsewhere. So sort of three programs or three areas of discussion, but you know, we'll be talking about rates, zoning, and other types of information and education that we have out there, because the water department has done a great job of this.
Mm-hmm. And at 5:30, you're scheduled to get an update from Deputy Fire Chief Pete Emery on the Parley's fire. Obviously, a very scary few days for the greater Park City area, but all the evacuations were not in Park City limits. What are we expecting to hear from Chief Emery?
Well, I think this should be really interesting, actually. You know, we were obviously part of the overall emergency response. Park City Municipal, you know, was a partner in this initiative because it was a community endeavor, and it was really scary, quite frankly. There were a lot of us that were called into work on a moment's notice and spent the next 48 to 72 hours supporting all of the various emergency apparatus that was underway. And so, you know, Pete Emery is going to give, I think, just an inside look at sort of the stress and the organization and the response. And there will be some stories in there that I think are heartfelt about people being evacuated, having to leave their pets, you know, not knowing if they were ever going to see their house again. And this isn't to scare people. I think it's to give them a real life example to hopefully accelerate their interest in fireproofing their house, making sure they have an emergency bag, and making sure they're more prepared for the next time around that something like this happens in our community. And he just has some really interesting inside baseball stories that we wanted to share with the community because we think it's proactive.
Mm-hmm. COVID-19 update from Health Director Phil, Summit County Health Director Phil Bondran. Obviously, earlier in September, a lot of chatter about a potential special meeting with Park City Council that was stepped back a little bit. What are we expecting to hear from Phil, and what will the council look to, I don't necessarily want to say achieve, but get an update on, provide feedback for? What are we looking at here?
Well, that's a fine question. I mean, obviously, everyone is eyes wide open with where, you know, things are going to go with regard to COVID, particularly with the winter coming. And I think that our council just wanted some time with Dr. Bondurant to step back before the winter season is here, before the onslaught of the additional tourism and visitation ensues, to know what maybe we're looking at, and if there are any additional regulations that we may be able to implement that would be beneficial to our community and the tourists that are going to show up. So, you know, we have a great relationship with the Summit County Health Department. We have let them take the lead with regard to protecting our community. They have the health experts, they have the scientists, and we've been very, very deferential and very supportive of their efforts.
Mm-hmm. I was tuning into the Historic Park City Alliance meeting yesterday. Phil was supposed to, or Dr. Bondran, I should say, was supposed to give an update there. He unfortunately had a conflict. Is it a similar kind of a thing? Is he looking for feedback from you as well?
I think so. I mean, I think he's going to be interested in how our workforce is doing, what type of measures that we have in place. But really, I think he's trying to set the picture of what the winter might look like, where the trends are going, and, you know, what are the trials and tribulations of the health department, and maybe how Park City Municipal can be supportive of their efforts.
Mm-hmm. Couples, things like consent agenda, professional service agreement for rail trail master planning. We already saw the rail trail repaved. Is that part of that larger project, that larger improvements that were approved, I believe, $800,000 a few months ago?
It is. So this is actually just a step back part of that. So recently we had a new slurry seal put out on the rail trail. We were receiving complaints about cracks and bumps and other aspects. But stepping back, we do have a long-term vision to overhaul the rail trail. But in doing so, we know it's going to require a great deal of community input, community feedback. So this is to get a professional consultant on board that can help us with civil engineering, rise over run, if we're going to widen it, if we're going to add some lighting. But a major component of this is the community input and community feedback part. So there will be likely a stakeholder group formed, several public meetings, and then this is also a civil engineering aspects of that exercise. So two components: we're enhancing our level of service for the existing rail trail, trying to make sure that we have a clean surface, picking up trash, dealing with the graffiti issues, dealing with weeding. But long term, particularly with the growth of the area out in the Quinns and Park City Heights neighborhood, we want to elevate the level of service in this corridor, and we're going to need to do some planning around that.
Mm-hmm. And also about $60,000 to be approved for the Park City Cemetery Cremation Garden Phase 1 project. When was this last on the agenda? Was it last fall, or was it last in the springtime, where this was last discussed by council?
Yeah, your memory is better than mine. I couldn't remember, but this isn't something they teach you in graduate school. But I don't mean to minimize it, but unfortunately, we're running out of room in our local cemetery here, and it's a terrible situation when you have to turn a family away when they're grieving. And we do believe that there are some short-term solutions with memorial walls and other kind of small granite bollards or stones for cremation-type burials. The atypical burial, it's becoming more typical. But we only have 6 plots remaining in our cemetery. And so we know this is going to be a long-term need. So two things are happening here. One is we're planning for the cemetery long-term. Do we need to expand it? If so, where? Are there other more efficient burial methodologies that we can have? And then in the short term, the $60,000 is buying sort of the bollards and the plaques and the other things that families can purchase.
Mm-hmm. Anything else for us, Matt, before we let you go?
Yeah, I actually do have one thing. So, each year, twice a year, we have what we call a capital projects or a projects open house. So tonight at 5 p.m. at the library, we will be having our fall capital projects open house. And our spring open house was a huge success. I mean, we had several hundred people there. And this is where you can learn about everything that the water department is doing, the Main Street improvements, the transportation department, the housing department, recreation, building, planning, engineering. This is a great opportunity for people to come out in person in a tactile way. They can speak with the various department managers at the city. We have all sorts of pictures and graphs and charts of things that are underway, and we need to hear from you. So we're hoping that the community comes out tonight at 5 p.m. on the library patio.
Like I said, busy week for everyone at Park City Municipal. Matt, thank you so much.
Thanks, Sean.
Joining me now, we have on the phone Education Director and Public Relations Director Jody Jones. Jody, good morning.
Hi, thank you for having us.
And Grant Writing Director Kathy Carr in studio. Good morning, Kathy.
Good morning.
All right, Jody, let's start with you. How long has the South Summit School District or the foundation been around?
We were founded in 2016, so we're going on 6 years.
Mm-hmm. And what are some of these primary objectives? I see student scholarships, educator awards, mini classroom grants. What kind of work does the organization do?
Just that. Our mission is to fund the things that the district can't fund. So We've focused the last few years on our scholarships for our students. We've been able to fund scholarships for about half of the graduating classes for the past 5 years. And we've increased the local scholarships that have been offered and awarded to our students. And we've also been able to award Educators of the Year awards, and trying to increase morale in that realm. And then this year we've just started offering some mini grants to expand classroom programs.
And let's talk a little bit more about some of these scholarship funds. How are they distributed? Are these all college-bound kids or all high school seniors?
Most of them are high school seniors. We've had a couple that may technically be juniors that have graduated early, so they do meet all of the requirements. We have a couple that have moved into the armed forces, and some have moved on to trade schools, so not necessarily your typical college or university. But there are, you know, a variety of schools that students have moved into. So we try to keep it broad so that it's an incentive for them just to continue their education after high school.
And how much money is distributed every year through these awards, or funds, I should say?
It's approximately between $30,000 and $40,000, depending on the number of graduating students. And we offer, it's a tier-based incentive program. So it depends on how many other scholarships each student applies for. So if a student applies for 5 other scholarships, we'll award them $500. If they apply for 10, at least 10 other scholarships, we'll award them $1,000. So again, it's it's an incentivized program so that, you know, we want them to be able to receive as many scholarships as possible. They don't have to receive or win those scholarships. They just have to apply for those. And, you know, we just want them to reach out and apply for as many as possible, because the more they apply for, the better the chances are that they're going to win some and get more money for their education.
And what are some of your primary funding sources? I imagine Kathy does a lot of work on the grant side on that, but you've mentioned a handful of successful awards galas. Where does some of this money come from?
Right. We rely heavily on our community partners. We've been tremendously blessed in the Valley to have great support from our business partners locally. And we've done some auctions at our awards galas that have been quite successful, and some paddle raises where community members have just wanted to donate, you know, $100 or a couple hundred dollars, and we put that all into our scholarship fund. And we've done some telethon type and text drives where we actually bring our students in and have them call or text people, mostly their family members and friends, and say, hey, I'm here with the foundation and we're trying to raise money for this cause, and would you like to donate? We've reached out to our alumni that way as well and had good support there.
Kathy, let's talk about some of your grant writing efforts. What can we say about that?
Well, so as the grant officer for the school district, I do write grants that's not actually attached with the foundation. But however, for the foundation side of things, I do fundraising, and as I've come on board and working with Jody, we've been able to expand our foundation so that we're offering mini grants. And so this is a shout out to Park City Community Foundation, who actually awarded us $2,500 towards our teacher grants. And those monies were awarded last week to several of our schools which they wrote for, and they let us know their needs. And so, like, things like the AP English Library, we were able to give them some money so they could build their library. We funded a second and third grade combo reading curriculum for Silver Summit Elementary. We have a sixth grade theater class that is new this year, and so we were able to fund and help them so they're able to do their first production, which will be in November. And then Silver Summit has a combined K through 5 science fair workshop that they needed some money for. So we were able to do that all with those funds from the Park City Community Foundation. So we're grateful for them as a partner. We also receive money from generous donors, like Jody has mentioned. But in particular, we were able to set up a legacy fund through Ken and Karen Wilson-Hume, who were pillars of the community, and both have passed away. And in honor of them, we set up a legacy fund. And their money will go towards helping students with their scholarship and their pursuits post-high school. Mm-hmm. So we have lots of different opportunities, and we're also signed up to go and be live for Live PC, Give PC. So we hope that folks, even if they're out of South Summit area in Park City, Wasatch County, they will look to us, the South Summit Foundation, and give us a donation to help us continue with our work.
Mm-hmm. Jody, you mentioned that the foundation also acknowledges outstanding teachers in educator awards. How does this work? I believe the timing is always in the spring. Is this a nomination process? Do they apply themselves? How does this work?
It's a nomination process, and we open that up to students, parents, community members, teachers, administrators, anyone who wants to nominate an educator. And we have different categories. We have a K through 5, 6 through 8, and a 9 through 12. And then we also have a support staff. So that can be anyone who's a classified educator, a bus driver, a school nurse, a paraeducator, you know, anyone who doesn't fall into the teacher per se category. And so we get a lot of nominations coming in from parents and also peers, and then we have some students that will write in and tell us how awesome their teacher is, or even a former teacher who has inspired them and impacted their lives, and they're great nominations to read. It's a really fun process to go through that and see. There are some really standout teachers, and it's a hard process because there are so many good ones, and it's hard to narrow it down.
I can imagine. Jody, we've also heard about the success around the string orchestra. It started as a before school morning class taught by a volunteer, and I understand that it's really transformed into a full-on program now, correct?
It's working its way there, yes. So Marcy Burrell actually started this program, and it was a before school program, and she started that as a volunteer, and then we were able to move it into the school, and it's taught by a part-time teacher, Mr. Timothy Rower, and we're now trying to get that funded into a full-time class position. The program, I didn't get the updated numbers ready for today, and I apologize, but the class has grown tremendously. We have a big number of students that are interested in it, and they perform concerts sometimes along with the band, and it's just an amazing program to see how it's flourished from, you know, just 6 or 8 students in the morning before school to, you know, a full class almost with a full orchestra. And so it's really fun to see, and that was funded by the Sorensen legacy. So we need to continue that because that was, you know, something that was funded by a grant, and now we need to take it over and get it funded through the school district.
Mm-hmm. And I know you said you don't have exact numbers in front of you. Do you have an idea of what would be needed to move that to a full-time position?
I don't. I apologize. I was going to look into that, and I didn't get to it.
Kathy, you said you know. What can we tell us?
I do. So
there you go.
Yeah, this is why we tag team and we work well together. So what was really exciting, too, was this summer in August, Tim offered a three-week free orchestra camp, and he had about 26 students and parents that came, and then they performed, and it was awesome, and it was really terrific. So we really, you know, in order to keep this going, we need about $35,000. And that doesn't sound like a lot, but it is when budgets are tight. So we're really hoping that we will have some people in the community that will see and understand the need and help us out. So we're hoping that we'll be able to fund that, because again, it's part-time position, and it's just really valuable for all those kids.
Mm-hmm. Sounds like a lot of stuff coming up for the foundation. We are just about out of time. Jody or Kathy, anything else you'd like to add before we have to go?
Well, thanks for having us, KBCW. We listen to you. We love you. We are strong supporters of the community. South Summit is here for everyone. Come visit us. We're just neighbors to Wasatch and Park City. So thanks for having us on.
Anything from you, Jody?
Thank you. What Kathy said, we appreciate our supporters. We couldn't have come this far without our community, and we're just grateful for all of the support that we received, and we're excited to continue into the future and see what more we can do for our students.
Wonderful. Thank you both so much, Jody Jones and Kathy Carr from the South Summit School District Education Foundation. Enjoy the rest of your day.
Thank you.